You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen Minari? Have you seen Sound of Metal? What do you think of these films? 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's host Maureen McCollum sharing a story about the time Wisconsin hosted a mini Woodstock.
Wisconsin Life is celebrating its 10th anniversary on WPR this year. One way we're commemorating this milestone is by asking producers to share their favorite stories. I reached out to Kirill Owen, a former technical director at WPR, about what her favorite story was. And this was the first piece that came to her mind. 51 years ago this month, long-haired hippies and flower children from across the Midwest converged on a small Wisconsin farm for a weekend of peace, love, and music. The Soundstorm Music Festival's lineup was stacked with mostly regional artists, but also included the Grateful Dead, who played a five-hour set. Historian Michael Edmonds tells the story.
It was April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin, of all places, just a few months after Woodstock. People wondered whether Woodstock could be replicated other places. So there was a little momentum to see what could be done. There was a local promoter of youth events who had the initial idea, but that was before Pete Bobo showed up. Pete was a biker who had been living on the West Coast. He met the Grateful Dead in San Francisco and stayed for a while on Ken Kesey's farm. And he lived to make a little money, ride his bike, have a good time. And he envisioned doing that for tens of thousands of people at once. The Dead were not famous. They were still relatively young. They were in their late 20s or around 30 years old. And they were still San Francisco's favorite house band. They were not a national sensation yet. Local officials in Poinette did everything in their power to stop it. You had a wonderful, almost idyllic, law-abiding small town. Several hundred people, where literally the churches outnumbered the taverns, and they were terrified of being outnumbered 20-1 by beatniks and hippies and bikers. And as one of the selectmen said, we didn't know, but they'd smash the windows and burn the whole town down. Hey, Saturday night. Yeah. That game garnered some press, and a grandmother up in Poinette, who had a big sprawling farm and didn't get along real well with her neighbors, said, why don't you come up here and see if you can have it up here? That farm, the farm of Irene York, turned out to be a perfect place for a festival, and she agreed to let them lease it for $5,000. As her son said in an interview, Mother didn't care what the people of Poinette thought, and she told them so. Sugar magnolia, blossom is blooming, it's all empty, I don't care. Tens of thousands of people streamed in and out of the York farm over the course of that weekend. The weather was gorgeous, around 80 and sunny. There was a little creek behind the stage, and people swam naked in the creek, played in the mud. There was always the fragrance of marijuana smoke in the air the whole weekend. There were no fights. There were no injuries. Almost everyone I spoke to who went said that they remembered it vividly and it changed their lives somehow. It proved to them that it was possible for 30,000 strangers to get along peacefully, ecstatically even, for several days and have 3 days of peace, love, and music.
Is historian Michael Edmonds talking about Soundstorm Music Festival, which took place in April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin. Former WPR technical director Kirill Owen mixed that story and wanted to share it as part of Wisconsin Life's 10th anniversary. She says she loves the fact that the Dead's obsessive documentarians have yet to find the audio from this show. Kirill hopes that someone finds a reel-to-reel in a box someday. She also just loves the story and Grandma York and has been a Dead fan since high school when she first saw them in February 1971. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we make space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to the Academy Awards on Sunday the 25th. So next up, it's Minari. Have you seen the semi-autobiographical film on writer and director Lee Isaac Chung's life in a family of Korean immigrants in Arkansas in the 80s? Bring your Oscar predictions, your must-love films, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film. Hiya, Anna. Welcome back.
Hi. Lovely morning to talk about this film. Yes.
Yeah, hi. Set us up with a sketch of what Minari is about.
So yeah, Minari is about a family, a young immigrant family from Korea, and particularly the father slash husband's dream to have his own farm, and they move to rural Arkansas, and some of the backstory is this family has lived in California for some period of time, doing so many of the types of jobs that immigrants do, and they're in this case, they both have worked. The young couple has worked as sexing chickens in a chicken plant in California, and these are the kinds of jobs that nobody really wants to do, right? They're hard jobs, and this young man has this dream to again have his own farm, raise his own produce. And that's when we meet this young family. They are driving to their property for the first time, and it's not at all what the wife expects. And so there, it's kind of some struggles that along the way, and it ends up being just a beautifully shot film. It's about this family and their adjustment and ultimately their pursuit of the American dream.
Minari is the Korean word for an edible plant in East Asia. And the film, it really ties food very closely to identity. How do you see those interconnections there?
So I think we really see this play out, particularly through the character of the grandmother. And the grandmother coming from Korea to live with this family. And, she's kind of this kind of fun character, actually. She embraces life. She has a particular bond she develops with the young grandson in the family, and she, it's her idea, in fact, to plant this edible Asian plant on the property, and it becomes a kind of metaphor for I think both the old world and the new, and embracing change in so many ways, but also allowing this family to have a connection to the old way of life. And then the young grandson who was born in the United States, it also sort of symbolizes the bond here between the grandmother and the grandson.
Oh, and he is going to steal our heart, that little guy.
Yeah, very cute little boy.
So adorable. Yeah. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Much of the dialogue is in Korean. What are your thoughts around representation, around, Asian American identities in this film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is it's interesting pedigree. Lee Isaac Chung, as you mentioned, the director, was born in the United States, and the film is produced by, has a thoroughly American pedigree. Brad Pitt's production company actually produced the film, but it is shot all in pretty much all in Korean. There's some English dialogue as well, and I think it brings I think an interesting perspective to, again, that immigrant experience. I was doing some background research on the film, and I know that I had read that Chung had originally wanted to adapt My Aunt Nia, and then couldn't, Willa Cather always never liked her books to be adapted into films, and so Chung kind of was taken aback by this, but he thought, well, I have my own immigrant story here to tell, it's so fascinating because there are so many parallels really to the story of My Aunt Nia, from 150 years earlier. And it is a kind of universal immigrant story in so many respects. So that is something that I think really I think, again, makes the film, just like when we talked about last week to Nomadland, a film very much of the cultural moment right now that we're in. And particularly so because of Asian Americans right now, too. All of what Asian Americans, you know, the headlines right now with Asian Americans sort of under attack in recent weeks and recent months, and really the past year. And so I think that also makes the film particularly timely right now as well.
In those Oscar categories, Minari received a nomination for original music score. And let's just take a moment to listen to some music by composer Emil Mosseri. Anna, how did the music play a role in your experience watching this film?
The musical score is lovely, and it you know, so much of the film takes place on the land that this family owns, and so the music really complements our experience of you know, exploring this landscape, you know, rural Arkansas, but it really does have a kind of beauty to the cinematography, and the music just very much complements the cinematography and the landscape. So yes, it's a lovely, really kind of an intimate portrayal of this family and their American dream for sure.
Let's continue listening to music from the Oscar-nominated film Minari. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, she's here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaching courses on film. Which performances did you enjoy watching in Minari or Sound of Metal? Who deserves an Oscar this year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Listening to an original song from the movie Sound of Metal. The song is Green by Abraham Martyr. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. These Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards. If you've seen Sound of Metal, about a musician who loses his hearing, would you recommend it? It's nominated for 6 Oscars. Join in, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, and she's our guide. So, Anna, let's start off with just a bit of the trailer here for Sound of Metal.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
We'll come back. Till then, Lou, we just keep going, okay?
No.
Lou, no. Let's play tomorrow. Let's see what it's like, okay? I'm going to be like a click track. You can play to me.
All right, so take us into this movie. What is Sound of Metal?
So Sound of Metal is the story of a drummer, kind of a heavy metal band, and he loses his hearing literally overnight. And this trauma of this sudden loss is really, you know, kind of where we're at the very beginning of the film, and then you know, the film is follows his journey ultimately to accepting that hearing loss, and eventually too he, you know, comes to embrace the deaf community. But you know, it really is you know, following this character portrayed by Riz Ahmed in just an incredible performance, and he comes to, you know, live in this this kind of home for not only individuals that are deaf, but also individuals that were former addicts. And so you have, you know, kind of the hearing loss and overlaid on there kind of the history of drug use. But it is it's a really great film, and kind of underscored by these themes of resilience ultimately. And, you know, kind of how this deaf, you know, him becoming deaf, how it impacts other relationships in his life. And again, just a really incredible performance by Riz Ahmed. And then supported as well by the character actor Paul Racy, who plays a kind of mentor to this drummer and helps him to, again, accept this loss, helps him to, you know, find support and community in this story. So it's a lovely story. I found this film to be incredibly moving, but also uplifting too. I mean, all of the films, you know, I think from this cycle of the Oscar nominees are uplifting in their own way, but I found this film to be particularly so.
Interesting, the film cast actors from the deaf community. How do you think that informed the authenticity of this film?
Well, yes, I think that is a really interesting casting choice. Again, another parallel from last week's Nomadland, where Chloe Zhao used so many, you know, people that weren't professional actors. This time around, you do have people that are, you know, from the deaf community, providing that level of authenticity. Now, it's interesting, Riz Ahmed is not deaf, and so there were some folks who said that, well, that's not right. You should have cast an actual deaf actor in this role. But it's interesting. Darius Marder, the director, has said that you know, he really wanted to have an actor that was not deaf and had to kind of learn how to be deaf. Ah. And that is so critical, I think, in this story, because we first meet this character when he is, you know, a hearing person, and we are taken through this journey with him. And we also it is a really traumatic experience, right? One moment you're fine, you can hear. And again, it literally happens to him overnight, where he has lost his hearing. Yeah. And Martyr was, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Paul Racy, who plays the leader of a recovery group for the deaf and received a supporting actor nomination. And, you know, he said that he grew up in the Chicago Club of the Deaf, and that he said the Santa Claus he knew was a deaf Santa. So he has a lot of connections to this particular, to this particular disability.
Right. Racy is, again, interesting because he was raised by deaf parents, and he's just been this kind of character actor his whole life, and does all these other things. He works as a deaf interpreter, and he kind of takes acting roles here and there, and then a deaf interpreter. And then it's interesting, he's also, in his real life, a lead singer for a Black Sabbath tribute band. So that was kind of interesting to hear. But, you know, he's over, you know, 73 years old, and this, you know, his first Oscar nomination, right? And it's so fascinating. And I think, too, this is a film, both Racy and Riz Ahmed, this is their first Oscar nominations. You know, the same would go for the Minari. We have, Yoon Young-jun, it was her first Oscar nomination at the age of 73. And so it's really interesting, this crop of films this year. We have so many sort of first time nominees that's something that really also, you know, is very much the truth here with Sound of Metal. It's interesting.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the film Sound of Metal with Anna Thompson-Hodgick. She teaches film at UW-Whitewater. You can join in. Have you seen it? Have you seen Minari? Do you think they deserve to be in the Best Picture category? What do you love or what did you dislike about these films? 800-642-1234. Sound of Metal also received nominations in film editing and original screenplay, but it also sound, right? I mean, sound is what this music is about. How does sound design give it a really powerful effect? What does it do?
I think it really sets this film apart, and, you know, it gives you the sensation as the viewer of this film to try to, you know, have some understanding of what our lead character is going through. And it does this very effectively through, again, the sound design, the sound editing. You know, when he, you know, for the first time is experiencing deafness, you hear a kind of ringing on the soundtrack, and then it all goes quiet except for just some little muffling noises. And this comes back later on in the film when our lead character, he decides to get these implants, which are quite controversial in the deaf community. And you hear when he gets these implants put in, you hear what he hears, and you hear sort of the distortion that can take place for folks that do decide to get implants. And it's just really
a highly sensory experience for for that viewer.
Right. And again, that's something that I think is particularly just something that's never really been done before in terms of our the history of American film. And you know, there, it's not that we haven't. We've had plenty of movies that have put deaf protagonists at the forefront. You know, famously, Children of a Lesser God.
I was just about to say that one. Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah, and that was I think 1985 or so. And that actress, Marlee Matlin, she won Best Actress for her performance in that role, and it was very notable because it was, you know, she was actually deaf. You know, you had other films where you had, you know, hearing actors and actresses play those kinds of roles. But this film is just very different in that it follows a protagonist who's hearing at the beginning and then, you know, goes through that process of losing their hearing. So
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, it was fun as usual. So I look forward to next week.
Me too. Anna Thompson Hodgick, senior lecturer at UW Whitewater, teaches courses on film. Come back next week for more Oscar buzz. Every Friday in April, Anna drops by to discuss two of the Best Picture nominees. So next up is The Father and Judas and the Black Messiah. Check out these films. Join the conversation next Friday. Just ahead, we have an hour-long conversation about cryptocurrency. Are you a Bitcoin user? Are you interested in starting? What questions do you have about digital currencies? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.